Hello and welcome to In Conversation with Ashwin, and you are listening to your host Ashwin, who will give you a window into stories and insights into the most innovative and interesting people I know. They've written books, created movements, built thriving businesses, and have insanely interesting ideas. For more, check out our past episodes on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, or any other platform you're listening on. Just search for In Conversation with Ashwin and hit enter and follow. Hello, listeners, and welcome to episode number 10 of In Conversation with Ashwin. The topic of conversation for today was video, content, and Bollywood. Now, we couldn't have a more befitting guest for this one. We had Aditya Pishirodi, fondly known as Pish or Adi. He's a former investment banker and management consultant with a finance degree from NYU Stern. But he left all that behind to join Pocket Aces, a digital media startup best known for its channels Filtercopy and Dice Media. After starting as a production intern 3 months, he was asked to take over as the head of video for Filtercopy. You might not have heard of Aditya himself, but chances are that you must have seen many of the viral videos that he has produced on your Facebook and YouTube feeds. He's created several online popular videos and worked with the likes of Akshay Kumar, Sonakshi Sinha, Ayushman Khurrana, and Rani Mukherjee. Aditya's shift from investment banking to the creative and media industry happened in a matter of 3 years. He was recently invited by Josh Talks, an Indian TED Talk equivalent, to speak about career choices and how you should think about maneuvering it. I watched the 12-minute video and found it to be super simple and solid advice. I would definitely recommend watching. I'll link that in the show notes below. And we discuss a bunch of things on the show. We discuss Aditya's childhood, how that has had an influence on him, and the choices that he's made. His work at Filtercopy. And the most interesting question I asked him was about how a video gets made right from start to finish. So he runs us through about for 8 to 10 minutes the steps that are involved in making a video right from the ideation till its final production. We also talk Bollywood about how it's evolving and what the future looks like. Aditya runs a podcast called Bollywood Weekly on the side, where he hosts different guests and discusses the latest releases. And I've been a guest on the show too, so that's how I got to know Aditya at the beginning. Interesting story is that Aditya and I, the way we met, right? In fact, we haven't met till date. It's just been email exchanges all through. He used to work at the same company I work in, so I reached out via email to him about his podcast, Bollywood Weekly, the podcast that discusses latest movie releases on the weekend. Aditya hosts different guests on it. So I found that idea super interesting, and I was also trying to get into the whole podcasting thing, and I wanted to know the equipment he uses, the software he uses to edit, and I actually shot him an email with half hope that he would respond to it. And he did. In fact, he wrote down very targeted answers to my specific questions, and he was happy to get on a call as well. And he ran me through how he uses his he uses the tool Audacity to edit. He introduced me to Audacity, actually the coolest tool on earth for podcasters. So thank you for that, Adi. And so it was a great podcast. I had a great time recording it, and I hope you guys enjoy listening to it too. So without further ado, enjoy my wide-ranging conversation with Aditya Pishirodi.
Hello, Aditya. Welcome to the show. Thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Awesome. Diving right into it, right? The first question I ask all my guests on the show. Tell us a little about your early childhood and how that has ended up having an influence on the person that you've become and are becoming.
I don't know how much my early childhood has influenced the person I've become. I guess at some level it must have. But my early childhood was actually spent in Pune. So I was born in Pune, lived there till I was about 6 or 7, and then came to Mumbai, where I was till I was about 13. I guess I think I had a fairly typical kind of middle-class Indian childhood. Most of my time was spent kind of, so I didn't have I didn't have a gaming console, or I didn't have any of that kind of stuff until much later. So most of my time was just spent like outdoors playing football or playing cricket or cycling or like running around. I guess if I had to stretch early childhood until my like early teen years and stuff, the biggest influence or the biggest thing that has shaped my current interests and my current what I want to do is that a lot of the content I watched was actually like not Indian content. So whether it was like from the cartoons I was watching, like Popeye or Scooby-Doo, even going into like movies like Jungle Book or everything else. And then later on, obviously, like Friends and stuff like that. It was all like, I realized this much later in life, but I watched a lot of like American and British content. And not because like a lot of people have this like elitist thing against, oh, I'm not going to watch Bollywood because, you know, Bollywood sucks and Hollywood is better. Yeah. It was nothing like that. So I watched Bollywood as well.
Yeah.
And Bollywood was completely like a fantasy world, right? Like at least at that time, like all the movies that came out. And so we watched it for that reason. But I realized like the other like regular day-to-day content was the reason I used to watch overseas content was because there was no Indian content that was really catering to me or plugging that gap in terms of what I enjoyed, what I liked. So I'm sure we'll get into this a bit later, but of many years down the line, I had this realization, like, why isn't there Indian content, you know, for a young me to watch?
Yeah.
Or for someone my age to watch, right from growing up to when you're a teenager or when you're in your early 20s. So that whole gap I felt was not like being addressed, and I believed that there was definitely enough talent and enough like you know, potential for that to happen. So in some long-winded way, that was one big influence that happened. In terms of on a more personal level, I think, like, you know, I spent a lot of time obviously with my parents, and I think the way they approach situations, the way they deal with things has rubbed off on me. They're, both of them are pretty kind of calm, reasonable, level-headed. They think through things a lot before making decisions. So I think is also seen in the way I approach things.
Awesome. And so tell us a little about college and what you ended up doing after.
Yeah, so so in school, so I come from, like, my whole family did engineering.
Okay.
Both my parents were engineers in terms of their, this I'm talking about in terms of education, not career-wise.
Yeah.
Both my parents did engineering. My mom was actually working also as an engineer for a point of time. My brother also studied engineering. And so it, like, to me, I didn't even know what engineering was. I was just like, oh, engineering is a thing that you do. Like, to me, college meant engineering at some point of time.
Yeah.
So when I was choosing my subjects in school, I did all like the typical science classes and physics and stuff to go into engineering. And then once I actually started doing physics, I was like, okay, this is not happening. I cannot. And by then, you know, in general, there were more options of things you can study. People had become a lot more open about these things. And I had moved out of India by then. I was in Singapore. So I moved to Singapore when I was 14. And the kind of, you know, inside the box thinking that kind of tends to exist in India when it comes to education was not really there as much. So I was like, okay, I don't have to just do engineering. I can do anything, not anything maybe, but there are many other things that I can do.
For sure.
So, and at that time, my brother was in finance and I really liked economics in school. So the two were not related, but it happened at the same time where I really liked economics, and my brother, despite being an engineer, did a minor in economics and then got into finance. So I thought, okay, even he was telling me, like, he didn't enjoy engineering, he just did it because he wanted to, I mean, because he felt like he needed to. But then he did economics and really enjoyed it and really enjoyed finance. So I thought, okay, let me just bypass this engineering step and directly go into economics and finance. So that's what I did. I applied to economics finance programs, and I went to NYU. And so, yeah, I was in NYU in Stern, which is a business school. It's a very typical undergrad business school. Like, everyone who's there who wants to get into finance and investment banking and private equity. And I guess right now, like, VC was, like, the next hot thing. At that time, the VC space was also just kind of starting out. So my college environment was that. But again, somehow, like, the good thing about the U.S. which is one of the reasons I wanted to study there, is even if your degree is in like one field, you can pursue classes in, you have a lot of electives, so you can pursue classes in completely unrelated fields. And they have this thing where you can do a minor. So like your degree is called your major.
Yeah.
And then you can do a minor, which is just like if you pool all your electives into one area and do like a mini specialization in that, you graduate with a minor in this. And so in New York, in NYU, I realized that the Tisch School of the Arts, which is NYU's film school, is actually like the top rated film school in the US and possibly the world. And I thought, okay, this is like an amazing opportunity. I'm anyway interested in like broadly this field. Like in school and college I did like some theater and stuff.
Yeah.
And I used to watch a lot of content. So I was like, this would be interesting. Let me sign up for this and, you know, just see how it goes. And so then I signed up for it. I started doing those classes thinking it'll just be fun, but I really love those classes, and like they, just the way they were taught, the thought process, the way things were done, just made a big impression on me and actually kind of impacted me a lot more than my finance classes did. And I was like, okay, wow, like I thought this was just going to be, you know, a bit of like fun and games, but I could actually see myself doing this at some point. But at that particular point, I couldn't quite figure out how to get into it because I didn't quite know what I could do or what I wanted to do, because I knew that I can't like be a writer or a director because there are so many more talented people than me who are doing that as their degree. There was no scope for doing that. And, you know, unlike banking or consulting or, you know, a lot of these other big industries or big multinationals, the processes there are very set in terms of recruiting, college placements. There's an application process you go through. There's like, you know, campus interviews. It's like all very systematic you know, organized. Whereas in media, even though Tisch is like the top film school, there's no real process for recruiting. It's just going, meeting people, networking. You know, someone by chance likes you, decides to take a chance on you. It's all very ad hoc. Yeah. Like it's, you know, and so... that was just too much of a investment in terms of time and in terms of mind space for something I wasn't really sure about or didn't know what to do with. So I went into the usual, you know, and being in business school, that there is also, because everyone around you is doing that, there is also a tendency to just get swept up in that and go with that. So I got into the usual banking, consulting space. And so, yeah, that's what college was like in terms of academics and professionals. Apart from that, it was just a great time and a lot of fun. Because going to college in New York City is great. It's a very different experience. And, yeah, I mean, yeah, college, like, you make a lot of great friends and great memories in college, which lasts. So that all of that was, you know, completely lived up to expectations.
Investment banking and consulting too. Filtercopy, which is now the largest digital media houses in India. What are your key learnings from consulting and investment banking that have helped you here at Filtercopy?
So honestly, I don't know if it's like a learning that I transferred, but the skills that you learn in banking or in consulting, the great thing about banking and consulting as careers, which is why I always tell people, I think banking or consulting are great places to see. Just teach you a bunch of skills which are extremely transferable. And so I think in terms of skills, like being able analytically, being able to like analyze data and reach solutions or reach conclusions based on that data and then inform actions based on that, right? That is a skill which you think, oh, in a creative field, you don't really need, or why does data and stuff matter? It matters a lot.
Yeah.
And like, you know, a big part of Filtercopy's and PokerAce's success is because of the emphasis they put on data. Like we have a full service tech team who is collecting all kinds of data, running a lot of like tests, creating algorithms to understand audience behavior, user behavior. So, and the insights you get from that, you know, are is actually what makes this content work and makes the content like stand out. And I obviously can't get into the specifics because it's kind of proprietary, but that's really one of the big reasons why FilterCopy has been able to, you know, A, maintain their level of success and continue growing, whereas a lot of the other digital players, if you look at now, have struggled.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you look at who was relevant 2-3 years ago, their relevance now is still because they made such waves 3 years ago as opposed to anything they're doing right now.
For sure.
And the guys who are relevant now, at least on YouTube, are more kind of catered to, like, you know, tier 2, tier 3 audience. And how sustainable they are in terms of their business model is up for question. Whereas Pocket Aces has been able to continue to be relevant even now and is still on an upward growth. And a large part of that is because of the emphasis we put on data and, you know, making the content creation process, you know, equal parts creativity and equal parts scientific. Obviously, the creative side is critical because you need that level of thinking. You need to be able to, you can have the data, you can have the insights, but you still have to then create something interesting out of it or to do something interesting with it. So that creative aspect is, of course, there. But being able to bridge, you know, most creative people are not very comfortable with handling data or able to think analytically. So having the ability to bridge that, to understand that this is what the data is telling me, I need to do things in this way, while also understanding that creatively this is what will work or this is what makes sense.
Yeah.
And finding a happy marriage between the two. So that has been like a big part of my job basically for the last year.
That's great.
And so in some, like, the consulting experience really helped because I was able to do that. And the other thing about consulting that helps is it's a very people-focused business, right? You're constantly interacting with clients in consulting. You're interacting with your own team, with your superiors. And the whole, like, everything in consulting is about, you know, trying to convince, A, trying to find a better solution for a problem that exists or for something that's happening. And then it's to actually convince people that, hey, this is a better solution. Let's implement this. Let's do this.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you, obviously it's a very simplified view of the world, but that is also very true of most of the work I was doing at Pocket Aces. Like, I would have to talk to my writers and directors and, you know, they may have a thing in mind, but I say, hey, this might work better if we do it this way for these reasons.
Yeah.
Similarly, we do a lot of work with brands. Brands have their own agenda and interests in their heart in terms of my product needs to look like this, my audience needs to get this, whereas we know creatively that may not work and there's a better alternative. So that kind of, you know, dual experience in terms of dealing with people and dealing with data is, I think, what has been great and what has been what has helped me succeed at FilterCopy and helped the company in general succeed.
Got it. Sidetracking a little here, but just a question that came up in my head right now is, consultants have a stereotypical reputation out there in the market, right? Like, okay, you guys think you know everything. You come in, give us some recommendations on some slides and run away without seeing what really has to go into implementing that. How did that reputation carry forward for you at FilterCopy? Was there any bit of, you know, okay, was there a difficulty in handling the role in a startup? Because It's not a startup as such, but it's not a big corporate house also, right? FilterCopy. So how did that role play and how was the shift for you?
No, it actually didn't. So the interesting thing that I learned is, like, when you're familiar with the corporate world and with this whole thing, like, you know, you, like, yeah, things, words like McKinsey and consultant and all of this stuff, like, means a lot. But when, like, it's a very insulated world. Like, that's what I learned after getting out of it. Like, the layperson on the street has no idea what McKinsey is, has no idea what a consultant is.
Yeah.
And most of my team, like, obviously my founders have come from a similar background. So they knew McKinsey consultant. They knew what that meant. And that's one of the reasons why they were keen to get me on board.
For my team of writers and directors, they, like,
they have, like, very you know, the corporate world is of no interest to them. And so they have no, like, they hadn't even heard of McKinsey. They didn't know what it meant. They didn't know what a consultant is. So
yeah.
In a way, it was nice. I got to kind of just let go of that image,
yeah.
But still use all of the actual learning and thought process into doing my work.
That's great.
Yeah, I think, and again, like, it was never a challenge because I was not doing the same role, right? Like, if I had gone, like, when I was dealing with clients, if anything, it helped me because kind of what you said, right? Like, most people are very curious about how did you switch from doing that to doing this.
Exactly, yeah.
It actually helped me cut ice a little bit. But, that didn't really come into play at all.
Okay. Awesome.
Also, just for the record, I don't think that's true either.
Yeah.
Like, the misconception is there, but I don't think the misconception is true.
Yeah, that's true.
Or it's not true all the time. It depends a lot on, like, the nature of the product, on the nature of the project, the nature of the client. And, like, at least, and I think there was probably a point of time, and there are certain cases where it is true, but, like, most of the consulting houses I know are actively trying to reverse that and get into implementation and, you know, be more involved.
True.
Yeah.
I mean, a long journey there, but that's true. The misconception is truly a misconception. Can you run us through how a video actually gets made? We don't have to go into full details, but can you give our listeners a top-level view of the process and how the final creation is actually? And as a producer, what do you look into?
So I'll give you kind of the overview of the process.
Yeah.
With the caveat that this is a very simplified way. In reality, a lot of this happens in a much more ad hoc way. And so anyway, just to get right into it, right? So the first step is obviously the idea. So usually we will have ideation meetings. And we will, as a team, discuss whether an idea works or doesn't work. And we obviously have our learnings and our thought process of why we think something will work in terms of the audience lens, in terms of our channel, what the tone of our channel is, what the tone of our content is, what our audience expects from us, making all of those kind of top-level content strategic choices of, okay, is this idea something we're willing to do or not? Once this agreement that the idea works, then usually whoever came up with the idea is assigned to kind of go develop that idea further. So when I say develop the idea further, it's basically starting the process of scripting. But before you write the script, you will first think through, okay, if I'm going to have 10 scenes or 12 scenes, what are the 10 or 12 pointers that I want to include? What are the things, whatever my idea is, what are the things that are most relevant, that are most, you know, most of our content is to do with, like, being relatable and for people to identify with, right? So what are the, if, like, hypothetical, right? A video we did recently was thing girl roommates do, right? This is just the first thing that came into my
head. Yeah, I could watch that video, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, whoever is writing that video would think, okay, let me list down, like, all of the things that girl roommates do. Now, what are the things that you feel strongly about? What are the pointers that you absolutely cannot miss? And what are, you know, you do research into, okay, have other people done videos like this? Is there content out there about this? And is my content actually saying something new? Am I doing something different from the things that are out there? But also, it's a balance, right? So a lot of times we have this hesitation of, like, okay, you know, this channel in the US or someone else somewhere else has made a video exactly this. Why should I do the same things? But there is a balance in that if there are five things about being a roommate that everyone identifies with, you have to include those five things. You can't not include them because they've been done before. Because your audience watching the video will say, oh, but why do you talk about this, 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 and this? Like, in short form, the audience time span and memory is very low. You've watched that video. That video came out a couple of months ago.
Okay.
I don't think you'll be able to remember off the top of your head more than two scenes in the video.
Yeah, yeah.
Or points in the video. So, and if I asked you the same question 6 months from now, you will probably only be able to remember that you've seen the video yeah. and who the actors are in it. So there's always that balance. But anyway, so eventually after sifting through all of that, a first draft of a script is written. Then that first script gets sent around to the creative team. And so like this is how Filter Copy makes videos, right? Like we are very collaborative. So it will never just be, even if like I've written a script, I can't just go and make it. Like the whole team will read it, give their opinion on it, give their feedback on it. We'll have, you know, like what we call like punch-up sessions or breakdown sessions where it's like a writer's room. All of us, like whoever is free, because now we have a pretty big team. So
yeah.
a bunch of us writers and like me as the producer and whoever creative producer as well, we'll get together. This is towards the final stages when a script is about, after it's gone through one or two rounds of feedback and changes, where we think it's almost ready, let's just lock it down. All of us will get together in a room. We'll read each scene by scene. And we'll all discuss like, okay, this is working, this is not working. And we'll come to a consensus in that room itself. So obviously with creative work, there's always differences of opinion.
Sure.
And there's always, you know, someone might think this works, someone might think this doesn't work.
Yeah.
And so that room is basically to identify those points and sort it out once and for all. So I believe that, you know, this should be done a certain way. It's my job to convince the writer. Similarly, if the writer leaves that she wants to do things a certain way, it's her job to convince me and convince everyone else who's there. So then finally all of those things are ironed out and then a final script is made. Then once the script is ready, it goes into production. And so we have a production team. And this is what I actually started off doing when I joined Filter Copy. The production team effectively is responsible for making that script from written word to actually being on the set and executing it. So handling all of the logistics, and obviously they will work with the writer and the director and all of that. So like figuring out the locations, booking the locations, figuring out casting. As the writer, usually the writer who's written it will either direct or assistant direct the video. And so you have a team assigned to each video of a director, assistant director, and DOP, which is a cinematographer who actually shoots the video.
Okay.
And so the director takes the final creative calls once the script is approved in terms of casting, in terms of treatment, etc. So a director may say, okay, I want this actor. It's the production person's job to actually go reach out to the actor and say, "This we're shooting on this date, are you available?" Handle all of that. The production person is also responsible for the budget. So we have a certain budget in mind where we say, okay, we can, if it's a video that we're doing on our own, we have budget for it. If it's a video that we're doing in a brand, we have this much budget for it, etc. And, the production person then has to come back and say, okay, you know what? We're over budget. So you either need to cut down two locations in the script or you need to cast a different actor instead who will be available for less. Or you have to give up something else, basically.
Yeah.
And so then that's, again, typically a conversation that just happens between the director and the line producer for that video. And then if they are not able to reach a consensus, then, you know, I would get involved and like our head of production would get involved and say, okay, how can we find a solution to this? And sometimes you say, you know what, this video, we'll have to go over budget, but we'll take that call because it's required.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
we'll maybe make it up in the next video, which we'll shoot and cut down on budgets, things like that. So the production person handles all of the locations, actors, all the other crew, like, you know, getting a makeup person, getting a spot boy, getting a stylist if you need one, getting any other crew that are getting a sound recordist, getting the equipment, getting all of that logistics basically organized and making sure that you come on set and everything is there, getting the props for the shoot as well. And so the direction team will basically give all the requirements to the production team, and the production team will make sure it happens or come back and say, this is not happening for this reason. Here's an alternative. Can we do this instead? And, you know, you sort all of that out. Then you have the shoot itself. So you go on set, and before the shoot, usually the director, the direction team will sit and they'll actually plan out the shot. So for each scene, they'll go and say, okay, we'll take these three or four shots from these different angles. We'll take an insert of this piece of this prop or of this thing. So that everything is like planned, and then you go on shoot and you just go ahead with it. Now, obviously, you know, you leave that little bit of creative license. So just because you plan everything beforehand doesn't mean you will stick to it 100%. Because on set, you might think of an idea that, you know, suddenly comes to you and you think, okay, this will work better. You might have planned something a certain way, but you go to set, you realize, okay, this is not really working out. This is not coming off the way we thought it would. A lot of times the actors themselves will add their own kind of variations or interpretations, improvise certain dialogues and things, give their own suggestions, which oftentimes, you know, adds to the script or adds to the video. So there's obviously, you know, the room to take all of that on board. So shoot happens. Once the shoot happens, then is when, you know, the actual process of making the video starts, which is the edit. One of my biggest learnings on this in this 1.5 years has been, like, the video gets made on the edit. It's like a common like phrase that we use. Like, you can have a great script, you can have great actors, you can have great everything, and if your edit is not done well, like, your entire video will just die. And similarly, you could have like a lot of problems, a lot of, you know, bad performances, but if you have a great editor and a great post team, they might still be able to salvage something out of it. So we've seen both those situations happen. So the edit is basically so once the shoot happens, everyone else's job on that shoot is done, like, more or less. Except for the director. The director then goes and sits with the editor. Usually the editor will make a first cut on his own based on just looking at the footage, seeing what works and doesn't work. Then the editor will sit with the director and they will go through it together. And the director will say, no, I want things like this, want things that way. And then the same, a similar process is what we do for scripts gets repeated for the edits as well. So the editor will send out that video to the entire team. Everyone will look at it. They'll give feedback. They'll give their suggestions and input. And then the director and the editor collate all of it. And then they will again sit and make the final cut. Awesome. And they will, and obviously, again, creative means subjective. So you will get conflicting feedback a lot of times. Two people may say, I really like this. Two people may say, I didn't find this funny at all. So then that becomes the director's call to decide which approach he wants to take and which opinion he wants to go with. He'll make the final cut. And sometimes I will also be involved in that process to make the final cut. Sometimes if it's fairly straightforward, all the feedback is consistent, I will just let them do it. And then I'll just come at the final step and give a go-ahead or a sign-off. Then once the cut is ready, you have all the other post elements like graphics, sound mixing, any, if there are title animations and like things like that, any VFX that's needed. Sometimes if we decide to change something or if like something wasn't recorded very clearly, we'll dub a few lines here and there, but like all basic like post work, and then video is ready to release.
Next question. Every video maker wishes his or her video goes viral, right? Has there ever been a challenge for Filtercopy or any other media houses that you're aware of in making a video with the aim of, you know, getting more eyeballs on it while at the same time creating good and meaningful content? And how do you deal with it?
Yeah, I mean, so for us, like, The term viral is like a very overused term, I think. And it's like a very, like, I think like what you described happens more when we're working with brands. And like a lot of brands and clients will say, oh, we want this video to go viral. We want to make a viral video.
Yeah.
Right. It's not how it works per se. And to be fair, like, I think it's now become like such a cliche and a joke. I think brands also get a bad name now.
Yeah.
Not all brands are like this. Some brands are pretty sophisticated and clever and understand this thing. But with us, it's a constant thing, right? Like, we want every video we make to be successful. We are realistic in knowing that every video we make will not be successful. And so we also set our expectations accordingly. Like, I think over time now, like, as an organization, Pocket Aces, we have so much information, so much data. We've done this so many times. We will have an idea of, okay, this video will work this well or will not work this well. And sometimes we're surprised, sometimes we're not.
Yeah.
But most of the time, like, that ends up being pretty accurate. So
yeah,
we have a view of which ideas or which type of videos will be sure short hits.
Got it.
And so when we are pitching videos to a brand, we will try to make sure that we give them that. Because that's when, it like, with brands, we have, like, commitments in terms of views and things like, you know, traffic and things like that.
Mm.
When it's our own videos, we obviously want our own videos, which are not branded, to also do very well. But with our own videos, we have more room to experiment. So for instance, we may say, okay, we know this video will not do really well, but let's make it because it has a certain message that we want to put out there, or it has a certain thing that we want to say.
Yeah.
Or we'll say, okay, you know what, like, you know, this video is being made for the sole purpose of getting us a new audience.
Yeah.
Because this is not an audience that we have in our page.
Yeah.
So we know that right now, like, we know that our audience doesn't want this, but we're making this, or they're making this video to get other new audiences onto our page.
Yeah, yeah.
So we know that that video on its own may not perform very well, but we think that the long-term benefits of bringing that audience will help the videos do well. So that's kind of, so like, as the head of the channel, that was my constant job to balance, like, okay, how do I ensure that I have two videos every week that go out, that I have like my view targets and various other targets that I hit, but how do I also make sure that the content is good and that, you know, it's a thing. So there's no clear answer. It's kind of a daily process to that question and to do that. And I think that's where a lot of the data comes in, right? Like, you can use the data to help inform your decisions better, to say, okay, like, if I have an idea of these other videos in my pipeline, I can then schedule them in a way that, okay, if out of the next 10 videos, I know that 6 of them will be sure shot hits, I will space them out and do them accordingly, as opposed to placing 6 hit videos back to back and then having 4 videos in a row which do badly.
Yeah.
Then if I have back-to-back-to-back videos that are doing badly, my page suffers. It doesn't matter what happened before. But if I have a good video and then maybe a middle-performing video, then another good video, middle-performing video, like, the troughs get balanced out by the peaks, basically.
Yeah.
And it's much better to have peak, trough, than to have peaks and then just a trough.
Yeah.
Because the other thing about, like, the way the distribution works and the way all the algorithms work is that, you know, your downside risk is much bigger than your upside risk. Or upside, not risk, upside potential.
Correct.
So it's like, over time, you can manage your programming in such a way. And yeah, like, for a specific video, we will, obviously, if I know a video may not do that well, I will go in with that approach and try to do things to make sure that it still does well. So I will either title it a certain way, or I will ensure that the video is kind of written in a certain way, or tries to get these emotions out to help it do well based on what we know. So those are things we do both on an individual level, but for me, more so on a channel level was where it became important.
Got it. Cool. Still staying in the content zone, but shifting from filter copy to now Bollywood, What's your take on Bollywood and its evolution in the past few years? What's in store?
It's very interesting. I feel like there are two or three like very different Bollywoods that exist now.
Yeah.
And it's hard to say. I think that in itself is a step in the right direction because you now have more diversity of content. You now have more voices being heard, more stories being told. So like to elaborate, like what I mean by like, you know, two or three different Bollywoods is like you still have your big, you know, Khans and commercial masala entertainers, which is just pretty mindless stuff.
Yeah.
And you have some of the new guys who are also going into that. Like you have a film like Juruattu that did, you know, amazing box office numbers last year.
Yeah.
And it was really just a 20-year-old movie, you know, repackaged with slicker packaging and same.
Yeah.
And in some ways that I found that a bit disheartening because like a lot of that movie is quite sexist and misogynist, and you would hope that, you know, in 20 years society has moved on to find this not acceptable anymore, but
yeah,
it is still finding an audience. So that'll take time. So that part of Bollywood is still there, and I think, you know, given the amount of hero worship we have to stars and the attitude we have to cinema, it's of, you know, we don't hold that cinema to very high standards and we keep paying our ticket money for it.
Yeah.
That'll keep continuing. But there is now this new breed of Bollywood which is more focused on telling real stories, is more focused on being a better reflection of our society today, right? Like, you know, Veere Di Wedding, and I haven't seen the movie, but it got the third highest opening of the year so far.
Okay.
In a completely female-led film, right? And, you know, Sonam Kapoor has been very vocal about how her and Kareena, being two of the top A-list actresses in the country, most sellable actresses in the country, really, really struggled to find people to make this movie, like producers to fund this movie and make this movie. And I think in it was a Film Companion interview where Sonam Kapoor said that, you know, Don Abraham and Varun Dhawan got like 80 crores or something to make Dishoom.
Yeah.
Which is a pretty, you know, insignificant film in my
opinion. Watch it. Yeah.
It's fairly useless, but it's two big stars, it's two, you know, male stars. Yeah. And people are like, yeah, go make this movie. We know it'll make back our money, which it did.
Yeah.
But for Veere Di Wedding, they struggled and they had to, you know, significantly cut the fees that they would take. They're obviously on board as producers, which is different. But they got it done, and now this opening is done really well, right? Razi with Alia Bhatt, again, completely female-led movie, no male star of note attached to it.
Such a great movie, though.
Great movie, and didn't need that male star to push it ahead, right?
Yeah.
So you're seeing this progression happen gradually. So last year, you had a series of, you know, female-led films, but which needed that male star power to drive them, like Pink with Amitabh Bachchan or Dear Zindagi with Shah Rukh. Now you're seeing that, okay, you've gotten your audience used to like a female character leading the film. Now we don't need a Shah Rukh or we don't need Amitabh to make this film do well.
Yeah.
So I'm glad to see that happening, and not just as a matter of like, I got into this whole, you know, male versus female discussion because Veere is happening right now, so it's on my mind.
Correct.
But the same thing is true of just generally having better stories being told, more meaningful stories being told, right? You know, John Abraham has been very targeted about doing movies about stories or things that matter. Like he just did Parmano.
Yeah.
You have even Varun Dhawan, after doing a Juruattu, instead of just sticking to that, was like, no, I'm going to do a film like October. Yeah. Which is meaningful, which is real, right? Long as, you know, actors like, the new actors like Varun Dhawan and Alia Bhatt keep making those decisions and they keep getting backed to make those films, then I think, you know, Bollywood is definitely on an upward trajectory. It's just a matter of, can we make that the norm and not, you know, the mindless
kind of movies.
Yeah.
Fair enough. One Bollywood movie that isn't so famous, but you would recommend that people watch?
It's a hard question to answer. So my personal favorite in this category was Dev D. I think Dev D was the film that actually kind of changed my thinking in terms of viewing film as just a pastime or a piece of entertainment to go watch. Dev D was the film that kind of changed my thinking in terms of viewing film as just a pastime or a piece of entertainment to just go watch mindlessly, to a form of art or a form of storytelling or of you know, expression.
Yeah.
And that film was just, you know, so different to anything I had seen before. And, you know, and I'd obviously seen Devdas.
Yeah.
And to see the same story told in such a different way, completely, was just incredible. And everything about that film, like that film is just like a assault to your senses, you know, like the music, the background score, the visuals, all of it just kind of, you know, is this very well put together film.
Correct. So
that is one film, but I'm also aware that it's not a film that is probably for everyone or that everyone enjoy it. But for me, that was my, you know, personal favorite film.
Awesome.
Another film more recently that I think is like everyone should watch is a film called Waiting.
Oh, I love it. Kalki.
Nasiruddin and Kalki.
Yeah.
Just a very simple human film, right? I really liked it a lot.
I love the recommendation. Waiting is my personal favorite too in this category. Probably one that I would recommend too. Thanks for all the information and really the great conversation that we've had. You're not with Filter Copy anymore. You're off to B school, so good luck for that. And thanks for taking the time to join us.
Thanks so much, man. Appreciate
thanks, Ali.
Thanks for having me.